The following Stealing the Mind Bible Conference presentation, The Great Debate, Creation versus Evolution, with Kent Hovind versus Scott Hartman, moderated by Frank Peretti. For a free catalog of all of our tapes and books, call Compass at 1-800-977-2177 or on the web at compass.org.
On my left is a really nice guy, Scott Hartman. He's from the University of Wyoming. He's a paleontologist and an educator. He's done extensive research and studies on the origin of birds. He's going to be beginning his doctoral studies next year on evolutionary developmental genetics. Please welcome Mr. Scott Hartman. And on my right, Dr. Kent Hovind. A lot of you are familiar with him. He's been kind of a regular fixture around here. I've seen his videos so many times, I should be able to do this by heart. He was a teacher for 15 years, science teacher for 15 years. For the past 14 years, with creation science evangelism, he's been traveling all over the place, talking and lecturing about creation, evolution, and dinosaurs. He has the unique distinction of having over 1,000 anti-Kent Hovind websites on the web. So... I feel like David Letterman sitting up here. Okay, I'm going to quickly go through the rules as quick as I can. This is going to be pretty quick. All right, each of these guys is going to talk for 5 minutes. Then we're going to get down to specific topics. Each of them is going to have 3 minutes to state his case. The other will have 3 minutes to rebut whatever he's saying. And then we'll have 5 minutes for each of them to close. And I have a watch. So... Okay, we're going to open up now. Mr. Scott Hartman will open with his comments.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You'll forgive me if I sound a little bit nervous. I'm not usually in front of this many people, especially when they think I'm wrong. I'm not going to fill you with a lot of facts and figures in this particular section. I just wanted to introduce myself so you know who I am and who I'm not. As it's been labeled everywhere, I am an evolutionist, and I am, in fact, an atheist. But I'm not here to convince you not to be a Christian by any means. Let me relate a story I had with some Christians last semester. A really nice group of people on campus started a question of the week group. And these weren't scientific questions. They were philosophical and theological questions. Why do bad things happen to good people? Does your situation determine your emotional state of mind? Things like that. And it was really, really nice because I went there and I talked with them and they were very open. They were very interested in learning things. It made me very open and interested in learning about their point of view. And I mean, at the end of it, they were still all evangelicals and I'm still an atheist. But I learned a lot and they thought they learned a lot. And that encouraged me to come here and show up and see how this goes. We'll find out. I do realize that a lot of evolutionists can come across as arrogant. And in fact, probably a lot of them are arrogant. Let me just apologize up front for that. I'm going to do my best not to be that way. And if I do, let me apologize in advance. Also, I don't know exactly the right degree naturally how to present the science, so I'm going to really try to hit, you know, the right head, not too much information, 3 minutes, not too little. If I fail, again, I apologize. I'll be available to talk about any of this if I was unclear afterwards. So, with that, I'll turn over the rest of my time. Thank you.
Hello. There we go. Automatic. We can get my screen up there, Phyllis. My name is Kent Hovind. I taught high school science for 15 years, and now I do seminars on creation, evolution, and dinosaurs. And I have been married 30 years and four weeks to the same woman. It's been wonderful. And I have 3 kids, one of each, and 2 grandkids now, and I'm really, really liking the grandkids. And my daughter and all 3 of my kids are married, and the dog died, so I made it. I'm home free. But define a couple positions here. I take the position that the Bible is literally true and scientifically accurate. God created everything in 6 days, about 6,000 years ago. The earth and the universe are not billions of years old. Bible says in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that in them is. And the Bible says very clearly that man brought death into the world. The reason we have death and suffering in the world is because of man's disobedience to God's clear command. 1 Corinthians tells us, by man came death, in Adam all die. People say, what difference does it make if you believe in creation, evolution? I think it makes an enormous difference. For one, if evolution is true, how do we tell right from wrong? I've asked this question to probably 400 or 500 evolutionists around the country. I say, I just want a simple answer to the question. If evolution is true, how do we tell right from wrong? I'm telling you, folks, if the evolution theory is true, there is no possible way to tell right from wrong. And we wonder why the kids are acting like animals in our school when we're teaching them they're nothing but animals. I take the position that the evolution theory is one of the dumbest and most dangerous ideas in the history of humanity. It is totally unsupported by science. It is a religious fairy tale for grown-ups. That's all it is. If evolution is true, then death brought man into the world, and death is the hero of the plot. See, this survival of the fittest has a flip side they don't talk about. The flip side that is essential for survival of the fittest is death of the unfit. If you follow the evolution philosophy right to its logical conclusion, you end up with Adolf Hitler. You pick those that you think are the superior species, you make sure they have more living space, and you annihilate anybody else who isn't the superior species. Evolution theory leads to Hitler and Stalin and a lot of mean things. Now, if evolution is true, death brought man into the world. Yet the Bible says man brought death into the world. These two theories are total polar opposite. They are irreconcilable. Somebody is wrong. And I enjoy showing them who they are. If you add up the Bible dates, you get about 6,000 years for the history of the world. And the Bible says before the flood came, the people lived to be over 900 years old. I believe that is literally true and scientifically accurate. During this time, when people were living so long, everything was living a long time. Reptiles never stopped growing. Even today, they never stopped growing. So reptiles would grow to be enormous in the pre-flood conditions when things lived to be 900. You say 30 seconds? Oh, okay. So dinosaurs were nothing but giant lizards that lived with Adam and Eve. The Christians have no problem with dinosaurs. And then Noah took them on the ark, probably babies. Just be sure to get a pink one and a blue one. And people killed most of them throughout history. They called them dragons. So the dinosaurs fit right into the creation worldview, and the flood formed most of the fossils that we see. According to the Bible, the dates given there add up to about 4,400 years ago. There was a worldwide flood that wiped out everything. There are nearly 300 flood legends still circulating the globe today in cultures around the world. So there must have been a flood to have so many of these legends. People would talk about that for a long time. The creation view says there's lots of variations available within the kind category. The Bible uses the word kind, and it says if they're able to bring forth, they are the same kind. That's how you tell if they're the same kind. A horse and a zebra can mate and bring forth. A horse and a pine tree cannot. Okay? They are different kinds. And I think in 99.999% of the cases, it is very easy to tell where the barrier is for the kinds. There might be a few places that are tough to tell, and that would be a legitimate study for biology to study where is the boundary for the kinds. There's 30. Okay. Science is something that is systemized knowledge derived from observation and study. Evolution is not a science. Evolution is a religion masquerading as science. It is not science. Almost all textbooks, states require textbooks to be accurate. Evolution is based on lies that are not accurate. There's nothing about evolution that's been proven true. And we're going to share some things with you today. They're going to show you evolution is indeed a dangerous philosophy, and you ought to give your heart to the Lord and get saved. That's what the goal is. Thank you.
Okay. Now we're going to start the individual points, and in this section of the debate, I'm going to ask both contestants to stick with facts and evidence only in the name of efficiency, fairness, and education and so forth. And we've already talked about no soapboxing and no ad hominem arguments. So with that, okay, Scott, you may begin with 3 minutes.
All right, thank you. Well, in case any of you are wondering, I don't support either Hitler or Stalin. Naturally, I disagree with some of the scientific points he made. I don't think I can convince you all that the world is 4.5 billion years old and that everything evolved from common ancestor tonight. But I would like to suggest right off that the evidence geologically about there being a worldwide flood is not quite so clear. The situation is a little more complex, maybe, than has been presented commonly. One common example is footprints. Now everyone's aware of the fact that there are dinosaur footprints. In fact, dinosaur footprints have been used in support of a flood because people have suggested that there are dinosaur footprints and human footprints found together. I'm going to ignore that issue altogether right now, and I will point out that regardless of who the dinosaurs lived with, there are multiple sites, including a really nice one in Wyoming that I've been working on and a bunch of friends have been working on. And the thing about that is that you can see there are multiple sites in the geological column. And you can walk right up it. So there's no question about whether we're making up the geological column. You can actually walk up the layers and see that on some lower layers, there are some dinosaur footprints on a little beach-like environment, and you walk up and it's like a shallow water environment. You go up higher and it's a different environment. But there are footprints on all these different layers. And that begs the question, if there was a single worldwide flood laying these layers down, how did the dinosaurs walk there? Unless maybe Moses had some sort of father figure who was walking around and splitting the waters during the flood so they could run back and forth as layers were deposited. It's very hard to explain how you would get footprints on all these separate layers that were supposed to be underwater the entire time. There are a lot of other examples of things like this. For example, everyone's familiar with sand dunes here, I imagine. There's even a bunch of sand dunes right here in Colorado. You can go see they're forming right now. Well, there are literally thousands of feet of sand dune deposits in the fossil record. Now you might say, how do we know the sand dune deposits? Could there be some catastrophic way to make deposits like this? Well, you can look at this and you can see there's cross-bedding here, and this is where a sand dune will form and be eroded away, and another one will form on top of it, just as happens in the desert today. Now the reason we know that this is something happening in a sand dune, not something happening underwater, is because when you have sandstone, it could be rounded or it could be fractured, and those can happen in a number of cases. But dune deposits are always frosted. A frosted deposit is kind of like putting a dull glaze on it. And what it does is it makes it not shiny. And if you can show me a way that you can do this underwater or anywhere except in a sand dune, I'm sure the oil companies would be more than interested and probably pay $250,000 of their own money. You cannot form frosted dune deposits anywhere but on dry land, and there are thousands of feet of them right where the flood was supposed to have occurred, interrupting these other layers. So, thank you.
All right, well, thank you so much. According to Mr. Hartman, stratigraphy does not support a global flood. First of all, I'd like to point out there is no such thing as a stratigraphic record. There are layers of dirt and rock. I think the Bible teaches pretty clearly the flood lasted nearly a year. It probably took 6 or 8 months to drown everybody. I think people were running for high ground, and then there would be tides, of course, coming up and going down, and they would run back across a few minutes later, or a few hours later, or a few days later, trying to find high ground again. And it's very logical to find footprints in all of the strata, or many of the strata. And also, while areas are lifting up, the crust of the earth was broken up during the flood. The Bible says the fountains of the earth were broken up. And I think sections of the earth would lift up and then sink down. The earth was broken up like an eggshell. And it's very logical to get sand dunes forming. It only takes a few weeks or months for this an area to dry out and for strong winds that are blowing during the messed up climate during the flood to form the sand dunes, which would then be cross-bedded and be embedded again under layers of strata. So I don't think it's as serious a problem as he thinks it is. There is no such thing as a geologic column. Stratigraphy means the study of Earth's strata. I taught Earth science for 15 years. There is no such thing as a geologic column. This was invented in 1830. Now, it's true there are many layers of rock. But if those layers are different ages, why are there no erosion marks between the layers? Why are these layers stacked on top of each other like pancakes? I mean, if one layer is 10 million years older than the one underneath it, don't you think it's going to rain once in a while in 10 million years? Folks, the logical conclusion is a worldwide flood would form all these layers. You can shake up a jar of dirt and water and it'll settle into layers in a few minutes. Charles Lyell invented the geologic column, he and other folks, but he's the primary guy, back in 1830. The geologic column does not exist any place on planet Earth except in the textbooks. The only place you can find it is in the books. This fellow admits it. He said, if there were a column of sediments, unfortunately, no such column exists. It doesn't exist. There is no geologic column. 80 to 85% of Earth's surface does not even have three geologic periods appearing in correct consecutive order. This guy says it becomes an overall exercise of gargantuan special pleading and imagination for the evolutionary uniformitarian paradigm to maintain there ever were geologic columns. There is no such thing as a geologic column. It doesn't exist. Also, there's no such thing as a fossil record. There are fossils, but there's not a fossil record. The textbooks say there's evidence for evolution from fossils. That's ridiculous. Absolutely no fossils could count as evidence in a court of law, because you bring some bones into the court of law and say, Your Honor, these bones are the ancestors of us today. They're going to laugh at you and say, sir, you don't know those bones are the ancestors of anybody. You don't know those bones had any kids. You certainly don't know they had different kids. But the textbook says evidence for evolution comes from fossils. That is ludicrous. All over the world, petrified trees are found standing up, running through multiple rock layers. They're called polystrata fossils. And I have scores of pictures of them. Go to my website. I'm going to run out of time here. DrDino.com. I'll try to get to one real fast here. Petrified trees in the vertical position are very common, proving positively, scientifically, the layers formed in rapid succession. Thank you. Okay. I get to start with point number two. Evolution is theory. It is not science. I guess I'm a little reluctant even to take that position. Evolution is religion. It's not even theory. It's religion. It's not science. This professor says, evolution is fact, not theory. Birds arose from non-birds and humans from non-humans. No person who pretends to understanding of the natural world can deny these facts. This is called a mantra, folks. They just state this like it's a fact and then expect you to believe it. Okay? Evolution is a dead or dying religion surviving only on tax dollars. It could not possibly survive without tax support. Okay? It's a ridiculous idea, and I, for one, am sick and tired of paying for it to be taught to the kids. Okay? Evolution theory is positively anti-science. There we go. There's not a shred of real evidence to support any of the theory except oft-repeated lies. Okay? Let's define some terms. The word evolution has many meanings, only one of which is scientific. Cosmic evolution would be the origin of time, space, matter. There is no scientific evidence for how that could happen. There are theories, but there's no scientific evidence. Secondly, there'd have to be chemical evolution. If the Big Bang made hydrogen, how on earth did we get all these other elements? People say, well, you can get fusion. Yeah, but you can't get past iron with fusion. Check it out. How did we get uranium from hydrogen? It is simply chemically impossible. Thirdly, there'd have to be stellar evolution. The stars would have to evolve. Yet nobody's ever seen a star form. All we see is our stars blow up. And yet it's been estimated now that every person on Earth, they just raised the estimate a few weeks ago, can now own 11 trillion stars to yourself. There's a lot of stars out there. We've never seen one form. Then we'd have to have organic evolution. That's the origin of life. Nobody has a clue how that could happen. Fifthly, we'd have to have what's called macroevolution, where an animal changes from one kind of animal into a different kind of animal. Nobody's ever seen that. Nobody's ever seen a dog produce a non-dog. And lastly, we have, and I object to the term, but they call it microevolution. That is variations within the kinds. Okay, now this one I agree with. It happens, okay? The first five are purely religious. So when we talk about evolution, I'm talking about the first five. I agree that dogs and wolves have a common ancestor. I do not agree that dogs and bananas have a common ancestor. Okay? So the evolution position teaches that 18 or 20 billion years ago, there was a Big Bang. I think that's ludicrous. They say 4.6 billion years ago, the Earth cooled down and formed a rocky crust. And then as the planet cooled, a rocky surface was created. This textbook says the surface was hot like the moon, and there were pools of bubbling lava. Then millions of years of rains created the oceans. This is what we're paying to teach the kids, okay? They're going to learn it this week in your schools. This one says, progress from complex chemical soup to a living organism is very slow. Yeah, it's not even slow. It's stopped. It doesn't happen, okay? This guy said the first self-replicating systems must have emerged in this organic soup. So their theory teaches 20 billion years ago, Big Bang, 4.6 billion years ago, Earth formed. It rained on the rocks for millions of years, turned them into soup, and there's Grandpa. I think that's silly.
Actually, I have a picture here of some of those polystrate fossils, just to show what Kent was talking about. The problem with talking about whether or not science, a lot of things in science have made mistakes, and certainly a lot of textbooks have showed things aren't scientific. But you can make a confusion between what a textbook says and what's actually being found by science. To tell you the truth, most textbooks are written by non-specialists, and they often copy out-of-date data. So when Kent says there's a lot of things in the textbooks which are wrong, he's right, absolutely 100%. We might disagree on how we should update those textbooks, but he's absolutely right. It turns out, though, that both sides can omit their details. For example, these polystrate fossils, they aren't just trees sticking up through the same layers. They're actually entire forests on top of one another. For example, if you go up to Yellowstone, they found vertically buried trees, but on top of those vertically buried trees is another set of vertically buried trees, and they have between 10 and 30 of these. Now, because it takes a couple hundred years for a good soil to form, you can go ask any ag major or
range management person, things like that. And it takes another couple hundred years for a mature forest to form on top of that. It's very hard to explain, unless the flood lasted a heck of a lot longer than a year, how you could have 10 to 30 forests form on top of each other. Because it has to be buried quickly, soil has to form for a couple hundred years, then you have to have forest grow, then buried, then soil, ad nauseum 20 or 30 more times. Now, if that is something that works really easily with the flood hypothesis, that's fine. If not, it's not scientific to simply omit or neglect these details. I mean, this is important. Details matter. And so, you know, if you look at this, if you come up with a really good model, and maybe there is one out there, it should be, you know, submitted and reviewed by scientists, and I even believe that some of them would look at it. I personally would be willing to. But that needs to be done. And I'm not totally talking about Kenji. I'm talking about it in general. This is what I think people who really want to support the creation of the model need to go out and do, is take these really hard data and try to come up with models of them. And until it does, I'm uncomfortable saying that creation isn't a science either. But I am more than willing to say when evolutionists are wrong or are not doing science. And certainly that does happen sometimes. So... you. All right, I get to speak again. No. My section is next. Thanks, Bill. Okay. Now, luckily, Tom Riddle went over Adams for this morning, so this is just going to be a brief review, which I'm sure you're all thankful for. Okay, so Adams. We know Adams exist. We know that because if you accidentally cut one, it lets a lot of energy go. So we're really sure about that part. We're really pretty sure that atoms are built out of three basic particles, which themselves are made out of other particles, but we won't go that far into it, which include protons, neutrons, and electrons. The electrons are the ones in the cloud on the outside, and the protons and neutrons are in the nucleus. And depending on what the element is like, you may have radiation. Radiation comes in two really common types. You can have alpha radiation, where the little electrons are popping off. You can have beta radiation, where parts of the nucleus are popping off. I'm sure you can see where this is going. I'm going to talk about radiometric dating now, which is unpopular, often because people cite carbon dating, which works in a similar way, but can easily produce spurious results. Carbon dating is very complex, because unfortunately, for the scientists who want to use it, almost everything's made out of carbon. I'm made out of carbon, you're made out of carbon, I'm sure Ken's made out of carbon. Everyone's carbon-based. The air is full of carbon, and the reason that's a problem is because carbon's in the water, and if you expose what you want to date by carbon dating to the air or the water, which, let's face it, is most things, it can really mess up your dating. Despite this, there are some carbon dates of artifacts which match up very well with both secular and biblical timelines, so don't discount it altogether, but it is easy to get incorrect dates with carbon dating. This problem is not so bad when we're dating things that evolutionists care about more often, such as when the dinosaurs died off. There we use things like potassium argon, lead uranium. And one thing I'd like to get out before my time totally goes away is that obviously there could be errors, and there are times when this, you know, when this comes up with funny numbers, but it's possible, for example, at the KT boundary, when we think the dinosaurs went extinct 65 million years ago, if you're one of my type of guys, is that you can date it with different methods. You can use argon, argon-potassium, and uranium-lead and get the same date. Now think about that. You could argue, as I'm sure will be done, that the rates of decay change, and that's not impossible. However, it would be funny if the rates of decay for these very different atoms all altered enough so that they still came up with the same answer. That would be weird, you have to admit. So, I guess, although you could certainly argue that they've all been, you know, changed just the right amount so that all the numbers line up when you can date it with these different methods, you could argue that that has happened, but that sounds really suspicious to me, almost like special pleading. So I guess my question would be for you to take home and think about, is it really reasonable to assume that, yes, these rates of decay may change, but are they all changing at different rates so that they come together and give you the same answer? Kind of weird. Just something to think about.
All right. Well, thank you. I disagree that the dates show the same thing. I think we get wild dates all over the scale, as I'll show you here. First of all, if you need to understand, folks, you can get my screen up there. Fossils are dated by the geologic column. They are not dated by any of the dating methods. The layers of rock may be dated by that, But the geologic column does not exist. Actually, radiometric dating would not even be possible or feasible if the geologic column had not been erected first. Now, he mentioned the different dating methods, potassium argon. Let me just give you a few examples about carbon dating, how it doesn't work, and then I'll get to potassium argon. Back in 1949, when they first invented carbon dating, the lower leg of a mammoth dated 15,000 years old, but the skin dated 21,000, same animal. In 1963, it's not getting any better, living mollusk shells carbon dated 2,300 years old. In 1970, at the 12th Nobel Symposium, they said if a carbon date supports our theories, we put it in the main text. If it does not entirely contradict them, we put it in a footnote. If it's completely out of date, we just drop it. Back in 1971, they said a freshly killed seal carbon dated 1,300 years old. It's not getting any better, folks. In 1975, one part of a mammoth dated 40,000 years old, another part dated 26,000 from the same animal. And the wood next to it's 9 or 10. Which number are you going to pick? In 1981, they said no matter how useful it is, the radiocarbon method is still not capable of yielding accurate and reliable results. There are gross discrepancies. The chronology is uneven and relative, and the accepted dates are actually selected dates. This whole blessed thing is nothing but 13th century alchemy. It all depends upon which funny paper you read. In 1984, living snails dated 27,000 years old. I could go on and on. Now, as far as potassium-argon dating, most people don't realize that potassium turns to argon, which is a gas, and disappears. The theory is that when a volcano erupts, it'll reset the clock to zero because as it erupts, it melts the rock and all the argon disappears and you start over with just potassium. It's true, potassium decays to argon very slowly. About 1.3 billion years would be the half-life, I agree. I'm not sure who watched it that long, but I would agree with that, okay? Now, here's the Canadian Journal of Earth Science. He said, in conventional interpretation of potassium-argon data, it's common to discard ages which are substantially too high or too low compared with the rest of the group or with other available data such as, here we go, the geologic time scale. That's how it's done, folks. The KBS Tuff dated 212 million years old. Everybody agreed with this for years until Richard Leakey found a perfectly normal human skull under the KBS Tuff. Then they had to redate it. Now they came up with 10 different samples and got numbers from 0.5 to 2.6. That's way down from 212, and even that is still a 500% error. It doesn't work. We could spend a long time on this one. Let me just give you a few examples of it doesn't work, if I can get my computer to speed up here. Volcanoes erupt all the time and produce potassium in the lava. A Hawaiian volcano from 1959 gave an age of 8.5 million years old. I'm out of time. The next points we're supposed to cover are that cavemen and horse evolution have been proven false. My contention is there never has been a caveman, unless you mean Osama bin Laden. There'd be a caveman for you. Let's see, 143. Okay. Every one of the so-called cavemen has been discredited over the years. Okay, there's the world's most wanted caveman right there. Nebraska man was an example. All they found was one tooth. Later they found out the tooth. By the way, they made an entire man and his wife and used it as evidence. We're going to use it as evidence in the Scopes monkey trial in 1925. This was promoted in papers all over the world as proof for evolution until they found out the tooth came from a pig. Okay? They find a few bones like the ones marked in red here and make an entire skeleton out of it. Here they found perfectly normal human footprints in rocks supposed to be 3.75 million years old. They said the form of his foot was exactly the same as ours. All kinds of quotes in National Geographic in April 79. They studied 70 people that go barefoot all their life and could find no difference between the Laetoli footprints and the footprints of modern people. But then the professor said, if the footprints were not known to be so old, we would readily conclude they were made by a member of our own genus. If we didn't know better, we'd think a man made them. The horse evolution is still used in textbooks, and why, I don't know. It's been proven wrong since 1950. Here's a 1992 textbook that says the horse evolution has not held up under close examination. Clear back in 1950, G.G. Simpson, who was a strong believer in evolution, said the evolution of the horse family has been unintentionally falsified. The tree was all wrong for the horse evolution. The horse evolution never happened in nature. This is 50 years ago they've proven this. Why are we still teaching this to the kids? It is still in textbooks today. The horse evolution is baloney. Darwin said, if my theory is true, there ought to be all kinds of intermediate fossils. They're making this up. The horse evolution story was made up by Othniel Marsh in 1874. He picked animals from all over the world. They're not found in that order. They're not even found on the same continent. The whole thing is imagination. Evolution only takes place in the imagination. It does not take place in reality. And if you find the early ancient horse, the Hyracotherium had 19 pairs of ribs, the next one had 18, and the one after that had 15, I believe. These animals are not related. One's about the size of a fox. It's a little meat-eating animal called a hyrax, still alive today in East Africa and Turkey. So the whole horse evolution is baloney. All the so-called cavemen are baloney. Folks, I don't mind if the evolutionists have some real evidence for their theory, but they're lying to the kids to try to make them believe the theory. Now, if they want to teach that in private schools, then you can lie to the kids all you want. But if they're going to use tax dollars, they better use facts, or I'm not going to be happy about that. Thank you.
Okay, I'm not going to have time to cover both horses and hominids in detail. I would like to point out that I've chased down most of those quotes about horse evolution being false, and they're not actually saying that there's no evidence that horses evolved. What they're saying is that Othniel Charles Marsh's idea of horse evolution, which you did point out correctly was his idea, that idea has been falsified. That is, he thought there were about 6 or 7 different kinds of horse that made an order, and they've now discovered 40 or 50 different kinds of horses, and have got complete skeletons for most of these. But we're going to talk about cavemen. Kent's probably right when he says there are no cavemen. The only actual evidence of hominids that have lived in caves is, in fact, humans. And it comes mostly from finding sites of human bones in there or paintings from primitive man. However, to say that the human fossil record is made up might be a little bit of an exaggeration. There are, in fact, oodles and oodles of hominid skulls out there, which for some reason don't get into these discussions. I'll let you figure out why that may or may not be. This is a chimp, and this is a girl at the bottom. The rest of these are all what we would call hominids. And except for that one right there, who might have been one of my relatives, who knows, the rest are not human pretty clearly. I'll briefly go over a little bit of comparative anatomy here. Or I won't, because that's not very visible. But basically, this is Lucy here, not quite as shoddy of a skeleton as been often made out. This is Homo erectus here, which a lot of people say is based on very incomplete remains. This is actually called Nereakatomi boy. It's one of literally hundreds and hundreds of fossils. This is probably the best complete skeleton. It's about 80% complete. That's a chimp, obviously complete. That's a person. Also, we know people pretty well. Scrolling back up, I can't go through all of these, but for example, here's a Neanderthal. The first Neanderthal was unfortunately based upon an arthritic specimen, which led to some really silly drawings of them walking around hunched over. This is one of the better skulls. This is not the most complete skeleton, but it is one of the best preserved. The bones almost look like they just sat out and weren't touched since they died. As you can see, these are not exactly incomplete remains. Just to orient you, these are members of our genus. So when a scientist says that the trackways out there might be made by a member of our genus, they might not mean that they're made by man. They might mean that they're made by Homo habilis here or Homo rudolfensis here. So again, there's just lots of evidence here. We're not making it up. Let me try to put this together real fast into an overall view, which doesn't quite fit on the screen. But if you take a look at the bottom here, and I don't even have them all on here because they're finding them so fast. Starting with Australopithecus afarensis, you can move right up past Kenyanthropus there, up more, past more Australopithecines. That doesn't look like something kind of between a chimp-ish ancestor and a human-ish ancestor. You can tell me what it looks like. Moving up through Homo rudolfensis, Homo habilis, various species of Homo, including Homo erectus and Homo ergaster. Moving on up, and thank you very much. Ah, yes, the fossil shore evolution. Okay, this one is near and dear to my heart. I've done a bit of research in this area. I can't tell you that I can that we have this totally solved, but this is, I think, one of the better transitional series. Okay, birds and dinosaurs. Perhaps these will simply be designated as not the same kind. That's a question I'm going to leave to you to answer. Let me show you a picture of some of these fossils. People have heard about feathered dinosaurs. These are Archaeopteryx. These are considered often to be a regular bird, not at all a dinosaur. Let me take a snap in here. Here's Archaeopteryx. Here are many of the known specimens here. If you restore them, it's quite easy to see that it's not exactly a perfectly ordinary bird. It's got a much shallower chest, very different pelvis. We don't have time to go into all of that or we're going to miss it. But there are lots and lots of animals that fall into this transition, too. Let me show you some pictures of the other fossils like I promised before. We show you the skeletal drawings.
Those are Archaeopteryx. This is not Archaeopteryx. This is a specimen called Dave. It's related to Velociraptor. You see this stuff in there and in there. Isn't showing too well. Those are feather impressions. That's a dinosaur. This is another one. There's the head of that guy over here. This is a nice close-up of the feather impressions coming off the leg of that dinosaur here. There are literally about 300 of these specimens now coming out. This is Sinosauropteryx. See those cute little arms? Definitely not a bird. Definitely a dinosaur. See the stuff along here, that dark stuff? That is for, like, feathers. Part of the problem here is the way that people often draw dinosaurs. They say they could just be overgrown lizards. This is a lizard of a colleague I have. It's very big. It looks nothing like a dinosaur. This is a skeletal drawing of the biggest lizard ever known to live today. These are dinosaur skeletal drawings. They don't actually look very much alike, regardless of how big the lizard gets. Okay. This is a brief overview. Once again, we'll start out. This isn't even a dinosaur. At the bottom, this is Marsupius, which would look a lot like a dinosaur, but isn't. These are all very primitive dinosaurs, which are also very low in the imaginary geologic column. Moving on up, these are Compsognathids. This is the guy right here that I showed you that picture of that had a little feather, like fur-like feathers on the back. These guys are called Troodontids. They're found with actual feathers on them. That's Velociraptor. These guys' relatives, like Microraptor, have been found with full wing and tail feathers, kind of like that, even though they clearly don't fly. And we even have a whole bunch of early birds, which help document the transition from long-tailed flying birds like Archaeopteryx and Jaehalornis up through Protarchaeopteryx and Omnivopteryx, to cute little guys with short tails. Now, I'm not saying this is the complete fossil record. There must be more out there to find, or else we're wrong. But I would challenge someone, if dinosaurs and birds are different kinds, to say, where in here do we draw the line between different kinds? I think this is a very important question, because we have things that look clearly like dinosaurs but have feathers, and things that look like birds. Thank you.
All right, I wish we had time to go back and talk about Lucy and Homo erectus that he mentioned about the cavemen, but those have been long discredited as evidence for evolution. If he is still being taught that in university, it's unfortunate. The university is way behind the times. Lucy was a chimpanzee. Charles Oxnard spent 16 years doing computer and multivariate analysis and said Lucy is not a missing link. Studied every single bone that they found. Donald Johanson found Lucy 2 weeks before his grant money ran out. He was sent there to find the missing link, and he found one 2 weeks before the grant money ran out. You better study Lucy more carefully. As far as similar skeletons on birds and dinosaurs, that might prove a similar designer instead of a common ancestor. Now, the Bible teaches very clearly in Genesis 1 that God made the birds on the fifth day, and he made the reptiles and creeping things on the sixth day. So the evolution view is totally polar opposite to the Bible. The Bible says God made birds first and then reptiles. Evolution says reptiles first and then birds. You need to understand, folks, these Christians trying to compromise the two theories are way off base, okay? This guy says dinosaurs are alive as birds. This is ludicrous, okay? In 1999, they ran an article about the missing link of birds and dinosaurs. Breaking news, National Pornographic, Geographic. The missing link, dinosaurs turned to birds, okay? Then a couple months later, oops, sorry folks, it was a fraud. Somebody in China made this thing and sold it to some sucker in America for lots of money who's looking desperately for evidence for his theory. We could spend an hour talking about how it's been proven wrong. Every one of the so-called dinosaur to bird fossils is wrong. The fact that you can draw some nice pictures on the screen of what it might have looked like, that's not scientific evidence, that's imagination. And all he gave us was a bunch of pictures of some artist's imagination, not scientific evidence. If you find an unusual bird buried in the ground, it might be there was an unusual bird that went extinct. You don't know that it's the ancestor of anybody. You certainly don't know it produced different offspring. This textbook says dinosaurs. Birds are the descendants of dinosaurs. Yeah, see, all you got to do is put a few feathers on them and say, come on, man, jump. It won't hurt too bad. Okay? It's not that simple, right? He says Archaeopteryx is a missing link. This has been discredited years and years ago, and if he's still being taught that, it's sad, and if he's believing it, it's even sadder, okay? Alan Fiducia at UNC Chapel Hill, North Carolina, one of the world's leading experts on bird evolution, says paleontologists have tried to turn Archaeopteryx into an earthbound feathered dinosaur, but it's not. It's a bird, a perching bird, and no amount of paleo babble is going to change that. Archaeopteryx means ancient wing. It had claws on its wings. 12 birds today have claws on their wings. As far as the shallow chest bone, Powhatan has that and flies just fine. He has a large crop for digesting leaves, and he can fly just fine. They said he's got teeth in his beak. Well, lots of animals have teeth. There are some birds today with teeth in their beak. There's a hummingbird in Ecuador with 48 teeth in its beak. Teeth and no teeth doesn't mean anything. Some of you have teeth and some don't, of course. That doesn't prove a thing. So I disagree strongly, and if he's being taught that there's evidence that dinosaurs turned to birds, he's been lied to, okay? And don't buy that for a second. Thank you. This section we're supposed to discuss now is only a worldwide flood explains the layering that we see. Back in 1830, they made up this idea that each of the layers of the earth is a different age, and they assigned a name and an index fossil and an age to them. And yet all over the world, thousands of petrified trees have been found in the vertical position, as I mentioned earlier. If you get a petrified tree running through multiple layers, it is not common sense to say the layers are different ages. He mentions the one in Yellowstone. There are 27 consecutive forests in Yellowstone, and his argument was it took so long for the trees to grow, and then it took so long for soil to form, and then it took so long for the trees to grow again 27 times. This is faulty logic. The fact of the matter is, when you look at Mount St. Helens today, it blew so many thousand trees into Spirit Lake, they began floating in the upright position as they got waterlogged. The root end went down in nearly every case, and the trees began to sink to the bottom by species. The Douglas pine settled out one time, and then a few years later, the different kind of trees settled out. And they're stuck in the mud at the bottom of Spirit Lake. None of them grew there, and they're running through multiple layers, and they're overlapping layers. Here we have a central Alabama coal mine where hundreds of petrified trees are found standing up, running through two seams of coal, the Mary Lee and the Blue Creek formation. When you put the evidence together, you can see very clearly the layers had to form quickly. Very rapid succession. There's a 30-foot-tall petrified tree found in the Kettles coal mine near Cookeville, Tennessee. The top and the bottom are in different coal seams, dated as thousands of years different in age. It's not common sense. So when Mount St. Helens blew, it blew so much mud down into the valley, it blocked off the river for 22 months. My sister lives near there. Quite an interesting mud flow. Thousands of strata layers form in one mud flow. Moving water and moving mud automatically separates into layers. You can buy those things at the mall with two pieces of glass and different colored sand in between. You flip it over, it stratifies in a few seconds. It doesn't take a long time. The trees blown into Spirit Lake in Mount St. Helens, there were 3 square miles of trees. You could walk across the lake. As they floated in the upright position, they settled out by species primarily. Thousands of them stuck in the mud at the bottom, and they're beginning to petrify already. It does not take long for things to petrify. We have in our museum a petrified pickle that somebody found when the lid rotted off the jar and the pickle inside turned to stone. There have been lots of examples of rapid petrification. Sometimes petrified trees are upside down running through multiple rock layers. The Bible says the waters return from off the earth continually. The Hebrew phrase there is halak vashav, the water was going and returning. This is the best explanation for all the sedimentary strata that we find and for the folded layers, which had happened as the mountains arose and the valley sank down in Psalm 104, the layers would be washed off by the subsequent erosion, and then you'd get cross-bedding or unconformities, exactly like we find. And we find petrified trees and all sorts of other things running through these layers. My point would be very clear. Stratigraphy does support a global flood. I think the Bible says in the last days the scoffers would be willingly ignorant. Willingly ignorant. In the Greek, that means dumb on purpose, of the creation and the flood. That flood formed those strata, folks, not millions of years. Thank you.
Okay. Well, there are indeed vertically buried trees on Mount St. Helens. Unfortunately, they don't look anything like the forests in Yellowstone that are buried upright. For example, Ken mentioned correctly that they're actually to a degree separating out by type of tree. The problem is on Yellowstone, they don't do that. What you actually see is a healthy climax forest buried 30 times. Now, if you're going to show me a mechanism by which water can take a bunch of logs and make them look like a healthy climax forest, fine, I'll be really, really impressed. But until that happens, there's no way you can claim that those 30 forests on top of each other just floated out there one at a time and dropped and just happened to look just like a perfectly healthy ecological community. There's no way. In terms of layers forming quickly, there is indeed a toy you can go out and buy, and you can shake it up in the water, and it stratifies really fast. The problem is, it's a toy. It's made to do that. Imagine, for example, you can do this at home if you want. It's pretty cheap. Get a fish tank. If there are fish in it, please put them in some other water container before you empty the water out. Take a bunch of pennies, enough to cover an inch or two, and a bunch of feathers, and mix them up really good. And if you shake them up pretty good, What's going to happen is the heavier ones are going to settle to the bottom. Now, this is the way that toy works, too, is the denser things settle at the bottom, and the lighter ones settle at top. And if you do this, you can get really quick stratification. And Kent's right. Some layers in the stratigraphic record are undoubtedly laid down quickly. Unfortunately, those aren't the only kinds of layers we see. For example, varves, and you can say these lasted as long or as short as you want, are altering in density. That is, low density, high density, low density, high density. It'd be almost as if you put a whole bunch of pennies and a whole bunch of feathers and shook it up, and what you have is 15 layers of pennies separated by 15 layers of feathers. Now, if you can do that at home, you give me a call and we'll make a lot of money together, I promise. But this does not happen in nature. The only way is if the bottom layer is already hard when it goes on top. Now, there's another problem with this suitability. Pike's Peak, I'm sure some of you have probably been out there, lots of granite. Well, this granite, had it been hot magma at one point in time, it interacts with the layers, so the layers had to have been formed at least sometimes before the magma got in there. The problem is that we know how fast magma cools. Remember that those laws of thermodynamics that were discussed so much this morning? They're absolute, and we know them very well. And sometimes you have literally tens of thousands of cubic feet of what would have been magma that is now solid rock. You cannot possibly get them to cool fast enough unless you're going to invoke that the rates of cooling have also altered. But now how many different rates of change are we going to say keep changing but somehow make it look like the evolutionists are right? You cannot make 30,000 cubic feet of granite cool in 6,000 years. It's not possible. Thank you. Sorry to stuck with me again. Okay, now we're going to totally shift tracks. We're not going to talk about the rocks at all. We're going to talk about a very special kind of DNA. I'm sure everybody here knows about DNA, or if you haven't watched Jurassic Park, they talk about it and make a lot of stuff up there. Okay, this is a model of a DNA. This is how a biochemist would look at it. But what they don't always discuss is there are two kinds of DNA in our bodies. Okay, here's a bunch of people. Sorry, that's kind of out of focus. This would be a cell. The cells are what makes up our body. And in there are two kinds of DNA. There is chromosomal DNA, which is the kind you learn about usually at first in genetics. It's what sits in the nucleus and makes most of your proteins. But there's these other things called mitochondria. They reproduce themselves, and they have their own set of DNA. Now, this is very important because, you see, during conception, mitochondria are only passed on by the mother. Here's an example of that briefly. The circles would be females, and you can see that the only way you can get mitochondria is from your mom. So all the kids here had it, but these people aren't going to have the same mitochondrial DNA as those people did because, unfortunately, it got passed down to a male, and the female came from somewhere else. Now, why is this important? Are there any genealogists out there, people like to track down your family? You can use this fact. You see, since my mom gave me and my brother all our mitochondrial DNA, my brother and I have the same mitochondrial DNA, unless randomly a mutation appeared. And you can use the fact that mutations don't happen very often in mitochondrial DNA to show if some person has 30 mutations compared to another person, they're pretty far apart for people. And people use this all the time with modern humans, see how close you are to the Vikings. If you think sometime in the Norman invasion, you somehow got some Viking blood into your family. And this isn't even controversial. They do this all the time, for things that have nothing to do with evolution. The problem is, you can use this for evolution studies. You can use it for a wide range of animals, and if you take humans and chimps, and there are two kinds of chimps, and gorillas and orangutans, guess what? They also fall out the same way the fossil record shows. Furthermore, since we know roughly how often these mutations occur, we can add up those mutations, and the timeline they say are separated is pretty close to what the fossil record suggests it should be. Yet another thing that just coincidentally comes together. With Neanderthals, we've actually found mitochondrial DNA in them, and we can find out that they are not human beings. They are totally outside. These are three of Neanderthal specimens we got mitochondrial DNA from. Totally outside the human range. So normal genealogy technology, it'd be totally admissible in a court of law, but if you apply it to something beyond just human genealogy, it still works. And we don't just do it with people. You can do it with horses and sheep, or sheep and whales. And it again and again confirms the dates that paleontologists got out of the fossil record decades ago. So, just one more coincidence of evidence coming together that seems to support this. Something to think about. Thank you.
All right, a couple of points left hanging from the last time. I'll use some of my time to this. He mentioned the VARVs, or high-density, low-density, high-density, low-density. Folks, go to the mall, buy those things with the glass I was telling you about. It's exactly the same thing. Two different densities of sand, high-density, low-density. Flip it over, it forms hundreds of layers in a few seconds. It doesn't all the denser stuff go to the bottom and all the lighter stuff go to the top. That's exactly how they do that, with two different densities of sand in there. Go check it out. Secondly, he mentions granite used to be hot magma. That is simply not true. Nobody's ever proven how granite was formed, and there's ample evidence that granite was never a hot molten mass. Go to halos.com and see Robert Gentry's work on radiopolonium halos. Granite was never hot. If you melt down granite and let it recool, it does not form granite again. It doesn't work. So somebody told you something wrong about that one. And now, DNA. Okay, if you can get my screen up there. The textbooks will say that we have evidence of evolution from molecular biology, typically referring to the DNA. This textbook says, Darwin speculated all forms of life are related through descent with modification. This speculation has been verified. This is silly. The DNA is the most complex molecule in the universe. There is no molecule that comes close to the complexity of a DNA. The average human has 50 trillion cells in their body, each one with 46 chromosomes, except for the gametes. All the DNA from your body would fill 2 tablespoons. Yet if you stretched it out, one person's DNA would reach from Earth to the moon and back 5 million round trips to the moon. If you typed out the code found in just one person's DNA, which would fill about 2 tablespoons, you'd have enough books when you got done typing to fill Grand Canyon 40 times. It is unbelievably complex. And to think that it happened by chance is ludicrous. It had to be designed. He mentioned the Neanderthals are not human. I don't know where he got that. That there's a range of DNA, mitochondrial DNA variation, and a range of variation in many different areas, you know, height, weight, etc. The Neanderthals were like at the one extreme end of the human range, but definitely human. Jack Caruso did extensive research of the actual Neanderthals. I want to get the book on the table out there called Buried Alive, if you want to hear the truth about the Neanderthals. They were probably normal humans living to 200 or 300 years of age because their eyebrows were getting bigger, which is normal when somebody gets past 70 or 80 or 90. Their brow ridge thickens. Jack Caruso spent 32 years as a dentist studying the growth of the human face bones. He said, folks, these are normal humans, brains bigger than ours, and perfectly within the range of humans. So DNA does not prove anything about evolution. The DNA is unbelievably complex. The chance of one DNA happening by itself is 1 × 10^119,000th power. That's a big number when you consider the entire visible universe is 10^28 inches in diameter. So no, we were designed, folks, fearfully and wonderfully made. There's no evidence from DNA that we're related to monkeys. It's evidence we have a common designer, not a common ancestor. Thank you. Okay. This was Bill's idea to go back to back. It's hard to get everything up and running, Bill. Especially when your computer is acting up. Almost. Let me start 10 more seconds. And this is the last question, right? We're supposed to discuss. Evolution is hindering the growth of the sciences. I think this is one I turned in. It's not one you turned in, is it? You don't. Okay. Oh, hang on a second. What happened? I'm sorry, folks. There, okay. There, all right. Back in 1799, George Washington was bled to death by his doctors because they taught a doctrine called the Doctrine of Humors. Science was way off base. They thought if you're sick, you have bad blood. Science has a long history of teaching things that are simply wrong, okay? And I think they're teaching something that's wrong today. They're teaching us that evolution is part of science, and evolution is not. Evolution's a fairy tale for grown-ups. That's all it is. Did I lose this one here? Nearly all branches of science were started by creationists. The evolution theory has added nothing to the advancement of science. It is useless. It is worse than useless. It is dangerous. When students or professors fear expressing their conclusions under threat of being flunked, demoted, fired, or ostracized, science is being suppressed. Okay? Any advancements in technology in the last 200 years have nothing whatsoever to do with the evolution theory. Evolution is hindering the growth of the sciences. I had some stuff before that. Here we go. Professor Bonar said, evolution is a fairy tale for grown-ups. The theory has helped nothing in the progress of science. It's useless. Professor Michael Ruse at University of Guelph said, evolution is promoted by its practitioners as more than a science. Evolution is promulgated as an ideology, a secular religion, a full-fledged alternative to Christianity with meaning and morality. He said, I'm an ardent evolutionist and an ex-Christian. But I must admit, and in this one complaint, Mr. Gish from ICR is but one of many to make it, that literalists are absolutely right. Evolution is a religion. This was true of evolution in the beginning, and it's true of evolution today. Julian Huxley, the grandson of Thomas Huxley, Darwin's bulldog, said, I suppose the reason we leapt at the origin of species was the idea of God interfered with our sexual mores. Ooh, now we get the truth. Karl Popper said, evolution is not a fact. Evolution doesn't even qualify as a theory. It's a metaphysical research program. It's not really testable science. Arthur Keith, who wrote the introduction to Darwin's book when it was reprinted on the 100th anniversary, said evolution is unproved and unprovable. We believe it because the only alternative is special creation, and that is unthinkable. There are thousands of scientists today and many thousands of scientists in the past who do not believe in evolution. They just don't. Many are fearful of losing their job for fear, you know, that because you get fired if you don't believe in evolution. But all the branches of science were started by creationists. We could spend hours on this one. Let me give you a few examples of those who have lost their job. Purcellville College in Virginia was told that by the American Academy for Liberal Education, they would not be accredited. Huh? They would not be accredited because they believed in creation. Dr. Denny at Texas Tech was offered $900 to debate me. He refused. He tells his students on his website, if you want to get a recommendation letter from me to go to medical school, you must profess to believe in evolution. Dean Kenyon was fired. Tenured professor, because he gave up on believing in evolution at San Francisco State University. There are thousands of examples where people have been fired or lost their jobs for teaching that evolution may not be true. I'm telling you, folks, in the Soviet Union, if somebody didn't believe in communism, they'd be fired. In America, if you don't promote evolution, you're going to be fired. And he's probably afraid to get converted because he knows he won't be able to get a job in the field that he wants to get a job in. Not because he has evidence for his theory, it's because of the religion involved. Thank you.
Well, certainly anyone who gets fired or doesn't get promoted because they don't believe in evolution is suffering unfairly, and that should not go unpunished. However, what really hinders the advancement of science is, rather than simply trying to provide evidence in a debate, is using quotes, many of which are decades out of date and out of context. Now, we just heard today how Simpson, an adamant evolutionist, has supposedly said horse evolution was false, even though he actually published papers on horse evolution. He was just trying to falsify an older idea about evolution. We can do this again and again and again. That doesn't help anything. In a discussion, what we need are the facts laid out. In the 1920s, there were a number of warnings from those crazy evolutionary biologists. They said, if we aren't careful with antibiotics, then we're going to start having bacteria, or resistant, you know, strains of bacteria evolve. Everyone ignored them. They said they're silly. They said if we're not careful with the way we use insecticides, they're going to evolve resistance. Everyone ignored them. These aren't exactly hindrances. One branch of science, which was certainly started by not just an evolutionist, but in fact an atheist, was that by Marie Curie, who started radiology. She worked on and discovered radiation. And if you want to know how many lives have been saved by them being able to go on X-ray by this evolutionary atheist, that's not a hindrance to the science. That's the only reason it's there. She dedicated her life, literally. She and her husband died because of her research. She never complained. She got to contribute to the benefit of mankind. Now, if that's a dangerous idea, fine. I don't think so. Now, if some horrible monsters in human history misuse the idea of evolution and use it to either kill lots of people who they consider inferior, or even just to fire someone because they don't like their idea, that's wrong, and we should stop them. But to blame all that on the idea, or even on the testimony of some nameless experts, is silly. I mean, if Kent were to stand up at the end of this debate and say he renounces creationism, that would hardly mean that creationism is actually wrong. It would just probably mean he hasn't had enough sleep. And likewise, if I stand up at the end of this and say I've converted, I'm no longer an evolutionist, that doesn't mean evolution is wrong. It just means I had too much to drink beforehand. Or I saw the light. It could be. But that doesn't prove it's right. So if we're talking about the hindrance of the science, I can give you a lot more examples about where evolution and evolutionary biologists have really advanced, medicine especially, even engineering, and we're talking about like plastics and other organic composites, and now that computing is entering an organic phase, almost all of recent genetics has happened under the guise of evolutionary theory. Now, is it all right? No, probably not. Could some of it be wrong because of evolution? Maybe, but despite that, genetics has gone so far in advancing medicine for us, it's not even funny. So I think these debates are wonderful. I think people can learn a lot by getting to look at some evidence, maybe some of which everyone's not fair with. But to say that evolutionary biology is hindering the science, I mean, maybe in some ways, but at least, you know, they're trying, and at least there's a lot of stuff out there that's good. And don't forget that mistakes are actually what makes science go forward. So just because they might be wrong, that's okay. In much the same way we used to be wrong about what did cause disease. And that's okay, too. We came to a different conclusion. That's okay. Thank you very much. Right. Well, just one more 5-minute period to sit through from me. Okay. I would like to say that we actually know a whole lot about floods. We've been watching floods for a heck of a long time. They're very important to us, and we actually know, we have a pretty good idea what they do. Now, granted, we've never seen a worldwide flood. Well, okay, maybe some people have, if you're right. But nobody alive today has, that's for sure. But there are predictions made by a worldwide flood which are very important. For example, granite intrusion. You can say there's no evidence that granite could have been molten, but if you're going to say that, you need another explanation for why the lava is actually intrusive into those layers that were put down by the flood. I mean, if you can come up with any other way it could have gotten there, I have open ears. But you got to have that explanation. Likewise, it's, you know, you can quote out-of-date scientists who are simply wrong. I know it's hard to believe an evolutionist is wrong, but evolutionists who said Homo erectus was not a human ancestor, they were wrong. Homo erectus is not just a couple fossils. There are literally hundreds of these out there. The guys who were studying them in the 50s, who can't quote it, who said, oh, it's clearly not a human, it's a monkey or an orangutan, there were fewer fossils then. We have a lot better fossils now. You can't use these quotes, you know, run them around like that because they're out of date. The evidence is always changing, and there's a lot of it out there. As far as imaginary dinosaurs, well, they're not teaching me any of that. I actually researched this. And a good anatomist can go through and show you exactly why a dinosaur drawing is drawn the way it is, if it's been done by a scientist, as actually about half of those were done by myself. So I don't expect you to all go home and pick up a copy of The Origin of Species. In fact, even if you believe me, please don't. It's a really boring read. But I do want you to just start thinking about this. The issue really is more complex than is being presented, I think, commonly in these venues. We may not be right. We certainly don't have all the answers yet. But I don't believe creationism does either. So, you know, go home, look at the evidence. There are other resources out there, some of which, unfortunately, are quite caustic or not as polite, but talkorigins.org is a halfway decent one. I'm sure Ken will have a different opinion on it, but there's at least a lot of information there, and much of it isn't too rudely presented. I just encourage you to go out and keep looking. Or if you want to come up and ask me if you have any questions afterwards. Just try to keep an open mind on the subject, because really it isn't as open and shut as I think some people would have you believe. So, thank you very much and have a wonderful evening.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Scott, I'm glad you came. You can't imagine how difficult it is to find somebody willing to defend the evolution view. The professors want to... Yeah. Thank you. Professors seem to want to brag about evolution in front of their class, where they have an obvious academic and psychological advantage, but they do not want to defend the evolution theory in front of somebody over which they have absolutely no advantage. I'm not afraid of them at all. Okay, I've been turned down over 3,000 times for debates, so it's an honor to have you here, and I'll be glad to do it again. Or with any professors you've got in school. Okay, I'll take them all on, same time. Okay? Now, We brought up several points about antibiotics and Madame Curie. It's interesting, you're right. Curie was an atheist and did start the Department of Radiology, but that has nothing to do with evolution. Radiology is just a hard science. That's the way it works, okay? And so it would not be anything to evolution, but I will modify my speech about that. And out-of-date quotes doesn't prove they're wrong, and I don't think they're out-of-date, folks. I've got things from clear up to the present. I use quotes all through. If you can, the date's right at the bottom. So that's a improper backhanded slap to say the quotes are out-of-date. That's simply not true, first of all. And even if it were true, it doesn't prove they're wrong. Okay? This is a common evolutionist tactic, though. Now, in closing, if you get my screen up there, I believe God made a perfect world and man wrecked it. It was man's sin that brought death into the world. Today, the world is full of suffering and death. There's no question about it. Charlie Darwin said, "I'm bewildered. I had no intention to write atheistically, but there seems to be so much misery in the world." Darwin and many atheists cannot understand why a good God would make a world with misery. Well, Charlie, God did not make the world that way. God made a perfect world and man wrecked it. But Darwin's philosophy, true to the evolution theory, is right here on the screen on page 243 from his book. He said, "Thus, from the war of nature, from famine and death, the most exalted object we are capable of conceiving, the production of higher animals directly follows." Folks, the way evolution works, the strongest survive, the weakest must be annihilated. This leads directly to Adolf Hitler. This is Adolf Hitler's philosophy exactly. Now, God made a perfect world and man destroyed it. By one man, sin came into the world. The Bible says man brought death into the world. You cannot blame a wrecked car on the manufacturer. Somebody wrecked this car, folks, but it's not the manufacturer's fault. They built it. It was nice coming off the assembly line, and then somebody wrecked it later. God made a perfect world, and man wrecked it, but he's going to fix it back one of these days. Someday the wolf shall dwell with the lamb, and God's going to put the world back like it used to be. And you're going to get to see it if you're saved. The Bible says the lion shall eat straw like the ox. A child shall die 100 years old. We're going to rule and reign with Christ for 1,000 years, Revelation 20, verse 4. I believe we're going to get to have our own pet dinosaurs and see what it used to be like in the Garden of Eden. And then he's going to make a new heaven and a new earth wherein dwelleth righteousness. God made this world and he owns it. And he makes the rules. And every one of us is guilty of breaking his rules. He told us very clearly in the Ten Commandments, commandment number 9, thou shalt not bear false witness. Don't lie. How many of you ever told a lie before? Frank, get your hand up. Okay. All right. Number 8 says, thou shalt not steal. How many ever stole something? Come on, you already told me you're a liar. Put your hand up, okay? Those are just two, folks. And so far we know we're all a bunch of lying thieves, okay? According to the Ten Commandments, we are absolutely guilty, which means we're going to have to be punished, or you're going to have to find a substitute to take your place. And that's where Jesus Christ comes in. 34 years ago, I asked Jesus Christ to be my substitute. I deserve to go to hell. He paid for it. Wonderful. I'm not going to heaven because I'm good. I'm going to heaven because I've been forgiven. Where'd you go if you died today? You really ought to think about it. And Scott, you ought to think about it because you are going to be dead for a really long time. Madame Curie died, all right, and she's been dead for a really long time. What if she was wrong? Well, Wayne Strickland here picked out his tombstone. He claims to be an atheist. Bible says the fool has said in his heart there is no God. It's obvious from looking around, folks, there's a designer. If you walk through the woods and you find a painting hanging on the tree, you automatically conclude there was a painter. Even if there's no evidence for him around the tree, there was a painter. The painting is proof of a painter. If you're walking through the woods and you find an old house, you automatically conclude there was a builder. The building proves the existence of the builder. If you're digging through the dirt and you find just an arrowhead, that is proof it is man-made. Even though it's a natural object, it took intelligence to make that. How a paleontologist can dig through the dirt and recognize a man-made object instantly and can't look at the world around him and recognize the Creator blows my mind. They have to be willingly ignorant. 5 minutes. We got five. Yeah. That was five? Oh, man. Okay. Thank you, folks.
I invite any one of you to speak with either one of these gentlemen afterwards. You'll find Scott Hartman is a delightful man, open-minded and willing to exchange ideas with anybody. And Kent, I don't need to tell you about him.
To receive a free catalog of all of our Bible teaching books and tapes, information on upcoming Bible conferences in your area, or details of our missionary outreach, call 800-977-2177 24 hours a day or on the web at compass.org.